The GAA Hour with Colin Parkinson is sponsored by AIB, proudly backing club and county.
I'm not finished yet, it took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
All right, you're welcome along to the GAA Hour. This is the football show. Conan and Stevie are with me as usual on a Thursday. And joining a special guest this week is Ewan McKenna, who's going to have a chat to us about this Brendan O'Sullivan situation that we talked about on Monday. How's it going, Ewan?
How's things, Colin? Me well.
Not too bad, not too bad. Come here, listen, this is my take on this situation now that we're on Thursday, right? So Brendan O'Sullivan went into a health shop, didn't buy anything over the internet like it was suggested. He didn't like the caffeine gels, so he went in and bought a stimulant that would be similar to the caffeine gels. I was doing a little bit of research there, and University of Toronto Professor Greg Wells says it's slightly more powerful than a cup of coffee, so it would probably have irrelevant performance enhancement. He admitted to his mistake when he got caught. He appealed it 3 times because obviously he felt he didn't do anything wrong. Well, he obviously did, but you know, he was trying to mitigate against the ban. That's why his name wasn't released so long. So there was no kind of cover-up involved. So my take on this, Ewan, is that this is a complete storm in a teacup. What's yours?
Well, on the power of what he took, it depends on how much you take of it, first of all. And we don't know that because the report hasn't been released yet. Secondly, I would suggest that even those who are living under a rock in West Kerry are aware of the dangers of taking supplements. Now, every time you hear an excuse for a failed doping test, it's either a contaminated supplement or it's salbutamol via an inhaler. It's very predictable at this stage. Now, he may well be telling the truth, but he should know the risks that are there. And God knows Kerry have a professional setup around them in terms of nutritionists and doctors who will keep them on the straight and narrow. There's a myth out there that's purported quite a lot, that it's actually quite easy to fail a doping test. It's not. It's quite difficult to fail a doping test, and you have to be pretty stupid, to be frank, to fail a doping test.
Yeah, I suppose he failed a doping test because he might have been taking this stimulant, which he would have thought was the similar strength to the caffeine tablets in the week leading up to it, you know, so that he might have been taking one a day. You know, caffeine gels that the rest of the team would be taking are completely fine. This one is, you know, on the banned list, but is no more, depending, obviously, as you say, how many of them he was taking. This is very, very slightly stronger, but it's on the banned list. So caffeine tablets, perfectly fine, or caffeine gels. This other one, then suddenly you're a doper. You know, when there's not much difference in between the two of them. But like you said, we don't know how many of them he took.
There's an app. I mean, you're surrounded by doctors who I guarantee you will warn the Kerry panel not to veer off into health shops or buy stuff off the internet. You've nutritionists with the Kerry panel who'll tell them identically the same thing. There's an Irish Sports Council app that you can type in what the problem or what the product is, and it can give you a warning. If it's a contaminated supplement, you see, I think Brendan O'Sullivan has been slightly landed in a grey area of the making of other people around him who are getting off kind of scot-free from this. Eamon Fitzmaurice, the Kerry County Board. Mark O'Shea was on Matt Cooper's show on The Last Word, I think, on Monday with Paul Kimmage. And when pressed, he said he had absolutely no knowledge that Brendan O'Sullivan took anything. He was in the dressing room with them all last year from the league final onwards. You see, here's the problem. None of this adds up. And Kerry can yerra their way out of football because they know it better than anyone. But I don't think they know doping very well from their actions.
Yeah,
here.
No, I don't think they know doping very well either, because this is obviously a new phenomenon in GAA. Like, I mean, we've only had 3 positives in the last 14 years. So I suppose how you deal with these things and how you might want to protect your player, it's all new. And the fact that he was appealing it, you know, should the Kerry County Board come out and name a player who has the right to appeal? And I actually think Malachy Clerkin had the best piece. I was reading on it yesterday in the Irish Times, and he said the issue here is not Brendan O'Sullivan, who admitted his mistake. The issue here is GAA disciplinary process, where you've got so many different bodies you can appeal to, and this is what held the whole thing up, and this is what caused the confusion and the messiness that's involved. And you know, the Kerry County Board named Fitzmaurice, let's be honest, they're not going to throw the young fellow under a bus until he gets the right to, you know, goes through the due process.
Well, a few questions I'd have here. Why did Eamon Fitzmaurice not tell his panel that there's a contaminated supplement, if there was a contaminated supplement, so that they didn't walk into the same trap? Why didn't the Kerry County Board tell every club footballer in the county in case they fell into the same trap? Why didn't the GAA tell every other county footballer in case they fell into the same trap? And why didn't Sport Ireland, via the anti-doping authorities, tell every other sports person in case they fell into the same trap? See, if they just named the supplement here, it would be very, very easy, because anyone who studies and is into doping with Wi-Fi for 5 minutes and Google could tell you if this is true or not. I question Anti-Doping Ireland, how a guy can serve a suspension and a year and a half later we find his name. If it was a pending case, how could it have been served and administered? A pending case suggests they're still investigating it and all the facts aren't known. But bigger than this, and it's an interesting one that you mentioned, that we don't have this culture in GAA. You see, we don't know if we've this culture in GAA.
But we don't know if we do either.
No, we don't. And my problem is that I think to assign guilt to Brendan O'Sullivan is wrong, but I think also to assign innocence without the fact is completely wrong and naive. And overall, in an overriding sense in terms of the GAA, to go, that's not our culture. I mean, I think that's bullshit. I Dick Clerkin wrote in his column during the week, he said, for what is largely a skill-based game with little or no significant financial benefits, the GAA will be largely protected from the incentives to dope that are prevalent elsewhere. Now, I've heard this argument over again. It's based on two things. It's a skill-based game. I'll take you to tennis, for example, is also a skill-based game where upper body strength gives major advantages, where there's a need for huge endurance, explosive bursts. Fatigue is an issue there as well.
Yeah, recovery is probably their biggest reason for taking performance enhancers, because, like, I mean, you could have a five-setter and then the very next day have another five-setter.
Well, stamina can equal EPO, strength can be anabolic steroids, recovery can equal testosterone, agility can equal stimulus.
Nobody's been copped for any of this.
You see, we're not saying this is the case. We're saying it might be the case, and it's worth looking into. If there's nothing to see, that's great. There's no harm in offering us a look. But we know that the GAA has shifted radically in the last 10 years. You're seeing a completely different specimen of guy coming out in terms of shape, in terms of size, in terms of power. None of that is assuming guilt. But to assume innocence is just as bad as assuming.
I'd assume innocence because I've been immersed in this culture for pretty much all my life, and I've been on these squads, and I've taken legal protein shake that was okayed by the doctor. I did the weights under Liam Kearns. I'd never done weights before, and my body transformed in only like maybe 10 weeks from my one rep max going to from 70 up to 100, a huge jump from doing weights three times per week and fixing my diet and taking this protein shake. Now, I think the idea that you would assume suspicion over players who get bigger when moving from an amateur era into a more professional era is absolutely outrageous.
It's not assuming.
It's being suspicious about them because they're bigger. So, like, it's madness. Like, you have to have more of than this. Like, I mean, Paul Kimmage wrote a piece in The Independent talking about the size of the rugby players. You have to have more than that to be creating this narrative.
We have right now, over the last 2 years, there's been 88 in-competition GAA tests, 91 out-of-competition GAA tests, and 17 blood tests, as they only started last year. But that's a total of 196 tests in that period, and there have been two failures. That's 1.02% positive test rate. Now, that's far too small a sample size to offer conclusive proof that there's something going on here, absolutely. But when you've positive test rate of above 1%, you can't just shrug the shoulders and say, ah, sure, lads are in the gym, sure, we're above that, we're this, that and the other. Again, that's not assuming guilt, but that number would suggest that this is something we should be looking
at. Yeah, well, just to cut you off on that now, because Brendan O'Sullivan shouldn't be thrown into that category, because all the into the gym category, because he took a stimulant. Like, I mean, it's of no benefit to him lifting weights. Like, I mean, he took a stimulant. You could argue that the Monaghan fella, that might work, that might apply to him, but I don't see how that applies to, if you're talking about gym culture, then we only have one failure that might point towards that.
But have you seen the case file? I haven't, and I can't assume guilt or innocence until I see the case file from Sport Ireland. You haven't seen it yet, you're assuming innocence.
Well, I know he took a stimulant.
We know he took a stimulant, yeah, and we know he said it was a contaminated supplement. We don't know what the contaminated supplement was. We don't know any of the details of how this has been gone about yet. And I wouldn't call a guy guilty or innocent until I see the facts. All I know is the dates he served as a suspension. I know what he took in terms of the stimulant, but not what it came from. And that's about it. I mean, I can't say he's guilty or innocent without that. All I know is he failed a test. But what people in the GA are saying, without seeing any evidence more than the tiny little fraction that's out there, is, ah, he did nothing.
Yeah.
We don't.
But then again, you know, the doping brigade, which I call them, the Kimmages and the Ross Tuckers, who tweeted about 15 times yesterday talking about steroids, which has no relevance to this case whatsoever. But like, again, it's creating this narrative around the GAA. And I'm not saying I'm right, Ewan. My instinct is that there's not a problem here. Paul Kimmage and Ross Tucker's instinct is guilty, guilty, because of the culture they're coming from and the sports they're coming from. Obviously, there's a middle ground here and we have to keep our eyes open. My instinct is to protect the player, because my instinct is that he didn't try to cheat, and what he took, from what we know about it, isn't massively different to a caffeine gel. So, like, I don't know, when you see the headlines, failing doping test, failing doping test, failing doping, it just creates, you know, a kind of story around Brendan O'Sullivan that he's a cheater, and I think that's a very unfair one to create.
Well, I think you're kind of shooting the messengers there. I mean, I think his own county board and the GAA have helped put him in this mess, because if he was, say, stupid, okay, if he was stupid and went out and took this, he went away from his own team, he went away, bought his own stuff, despite the fact he was warned against it, despite the fact he knows what can happen. If he was merely stupid, the best way to clear his name is transparency. There was a case in 2015, for example. There were a couple of Welsh sprinters who also used the contaminated supplement line, Rhys Williams and Gareth Warburton. Now, they came out afterwards, they went away, and they published the name and all the details about this contaminated supplement, so all of a sudden you could actually give them the benefit of the doubt in this case. Why can't Kerry now do this? I've rang the Kerry County Board, no comment. There's nothing to see here. Brendan O'Sullivan hasn't said anything. If there is nothing to see here, then show us. We'll all look in. There's nothing to see here. The guy made a mistake. The quickest way to clear this guy's name from his own stupidity is transparency, and we've had none of it.
Yeah. And I would agree on that. I'd love transparency as well, to know what he took, and for it to act as a warning to other county members. And this will reinforce to other county panels not to move away from what your doctor gives you. Brendan O'Sullivan's made a mistake in my eyes. But, like, I mean, you have to remember, this is a Kerry County Board who's run by amateurs. They're not professional enough or have the experience enough to know the exact formula for dealing with such an issue. You know, I'm sure their instinct is to protect Brendan O'Sullivan rather than go, right, how do we professionally keep everybody happy by transparency and by keeping this, you know, keeping everybody happy? I would have a little bit of sympathy for all of them involved down there.
It's also a Kerry County Board that can raise millions in fundraising. I mean, I think, God, they're amateurs. They don't have a clue what they're doing. When you're looking at the top teams, they're very, very good at what they're doing.
Ewan, they're all right at fundraising because they've got legends they can send to New York. You know as well as I do, county boards around the country, and we've spoken about this lots of time, they're absolutely the opposite of professionals. They don't know whether they're coming or going. Most of them can't fundraise. It's run by fellas trying to do it in their spare time, and to, you know, criticise them for not knowing how to deal with such a big kind of issue, I think that's harsh too.
Well, what about the panel then? Eamon Fitzmaurice has a lot of professionals around him who are bloody well paid, as most county panels do. I mean, in fact, seemingly they're the only ones being paid on county panels. What about them? Why was this not released to the panel last year? Why would you not tell anyone in that team? You see, I don't know.
Maybe they didn't want to get it out. I would imagine the way this was dealt with the squad was that they were maybe reinforced about, the doctor talked to them about what they can and can't take. Maybe they were called in and given better education the following year rather than calling in a panel, telling them Brendan O'Sullivan failed a doping test. The panel gets narrowed down, two or three lads go off the panel, then this all gets out. You know, I don't think they could tell the panel Brendan O'Sullivan failed it. Maybe they brought them in as a group and
Could they not name the one? Do you get what I'm saying? But it's the most basic of logic. If someone if I'm a manager and someone in my panel takes a contaminated supplement that's legitimately contaminated, this is legitimately a mistake, the first thing I will do is get every player together, say, this has happened, none of ye touched this supplement. I find it a massive stretch of the imagination to kind of say that didn't happen. And Mark O'Shea said that didn't happen. He also went with the kind of argument that he's an exemplary young man, he's a great young fella. And this again is this, that's a lazy assumption that people who dope are bad people. People who cheat are absolute, it's human nature. We all cheat in all sorts of walks of life. To assume that only bad people cheat is a massive mistake. And this is the kind of the Kerry defence. Tomás and Mark have both come out with this kind of thing that he's a great young fella, I know his family, he'd never do anything purposely wrong. He's not bad. He could be a great fella. He could be the nicest. Some people who dope are the nicest fellas in the world. And one other point.
See, that's not fair. Some people who dope. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's not fair to say some people. Like, I mean, to say some people who dope means it could be a fella pumping himself full of steroids, and we're talking about a fella who took a stimulant that is no stronger than a cup of coffee. Like, I mean, people who dope. But I wouldn't like Brendan O'Sullivan thrown into that kind of group.
People who avoid tax could be someone who owes €1,000 or owns €1 million.
That's fair enough too. But like, I mean, I did make that point that I think it's unfair to throw them all into the same category. I'm not criticising the people who reported it. I just think it's unfair that when someone fails a doping test, they're all pooled in together, as in all the same type of culprit. And doping is bad, so he's bad. You know, that's the point I'm trying to make. But listen, we've gone way over time on that, Ewan. You know, I think that you're right on the message that everyone should learn a lesson from this and should keep their eyes open. Basically, that's the learning, right?
I think there was a chance for a lesson. I think it may have been missed in the way this has been handled. And I do feel sorry for Brendan O'Sullivan. I don't want to make this about him, because I think there are bigger fish ready to fry over the way it's been handled.
Okay. Ewan, thanks very much for taking the call.
No problem.
Yeah, Stevie, I'm sick of talking about this. Conan talked a bit about it on Monday when I wasn't shouting him down. But what's your take on this whole thing?
Yeah, well, listen, we understand that Brendan O'Sullivan, you know, there's been a lot of talk this week about it. My take on any player taking any products that hasn't been endorsed by their county board or team doctor, you know, it shouldn't happen. You know, even though Brendan went into a health shop to select and pick a product that he felt would have been fine, I don't think he should have taken the risk. He's probably young and naive in that particular instance, but, you know, he's certainly paid the price for it. But, you know, from my own experience, you know, we've got plenty of warnings when we were with Armagh from about 2005 onwards. You know, we maybe had 3 to 4 meetings per year with the team doctor about what we could take, what we couldn't take. And, you know, if there was any flus, he would recommend and advise us to contact him immediately, and he would direct us towards the right type of tablets or whatever to take medicine to take. And certainly, you know, from Brendan O'Sullivan's point of view, it was a huge mistake. I think there was a huge bit of naivety there, and, you know, I don't think he should have run the risk of taking a product that wasn't endorsed by the team doctor.
Yeah, no, I think we'll all agree on that and move on. I think that the issue, maybe a lot of people are saying, are educating the players. In my experience, Laois players were well educated never to take anything other than what you, unless you ask the team doctor. You and Armagh were educated really well. There's some stories coming out that other counties aren't educated. So, like, I mean, that's just negligence if county players are not being told and educated on what they can and can't take. So we don't want situations like this arising anymore. It's taken up too much of our time talking about it. We'll be back in a second and we'll start talking about football.
I've had fellas follow me, and not just Cork lads, you know what I mean? It happens, yeah. And it does happen, but I'll tell you one thing, it's a lonely spot, and the best thing you can do is keep moving. And I thought Connolly looked to be trying to do that the last time.
The camera show, it doesn't look great. Yeah, there was maybe they could say it was theatrical or whatever, but like the reality is that there was contact, and I wasn't trying to win a penalty, I was trying to go out and win the ball.
You know, actually, it's funny, your man Conan, what's his name on your program? Like, I was wondering, was he at the same match as me? He was kind of making out terrible, but unlucky to lose. Like, let's go. 10% luck, 20% skill, 15% concentrated power of will, 5% pleasure,
50% pain, 100% reason to remember the name. AIB, backing club and county.
Down versus Armagh. This is the big rivalry, one of the big rivalries up north, Stevie, and one of my earliest memories of Down versus Armagh was ye hammering them in an Ulster final, which really kicked ye on as a team. It was the start of your great team, and it was the start of your great team. You and Oisín ran amok inside.
No, I didn't, unfortunately.
Marston and Oisín ran amok inside.
I was on the sideline that day.
Marston and Oisín.
Oisín, I think, finished the game at 2-7, but it certainly was the kickstart for Armagh. Although, you know, the year before we kind of knocked on the door. We beat Down the year before in the first round in Clonus, and then got hammered by Derry in 1988. So, there's no doubt that the Ulster final in 1999 really kickstarted the Armagh,
era
of the Noughties. And, you know, it was a fantastic manner in which we went about the match and beat Down. Down obviously had the upper hand in Armagh in advance of that there. And, you know, my own experience of playing inter-county football, my main rivals were always Tyrone, because we were fierce competitors and we were always coming up against one another, and they were beating us and we were beating them, and you know the competition was always tough and intense between us. But the likes of Kieran McGeaney, Paul McGrain, Jamard Marsden, they would always have said that their main rivalry was always between Down and Armagh,
right?
Because you know they faced many times in the early 90s and Down always had the upper hand, and obviously they went to school with some of the Down players, and Yuri went to St Coleman's and the Abbey Grammar, and they would have come up against those guys quite often. So I didn't just, while I lived closer to Down than any of the Armagh players, and I probably live closer to Park Esler than any of the Down players do now, that rivalry was never there for me, because I always played in a team that had the upper hand in Down in championship games.
Right, okay, that's interesting. Armagh have well got the upper hand now, Conor. I think it's 5 in a row, and it's stretching back to at least 1999 when that would have started. So this is another rivalry based on history rather than current kind of matches.
The Ulster Championship's basically based on history at the minute. Like, you know, you're giving off about it. And I was saying, like, the reason everyone thinks the Ulster Championship is good is because of teams like Armagh and Down and Derry, who aren't that good anymore. I mean, what Stevie says is interesting about the Tyrone rivalry, but of course, I mean, that was an era where Armagh and Tyrone were the two best teams in Ireland.
Yeah.
Playing each other every single year in the province. And that's why, you know, they ended up moving the Ulster Championship final to Croke Park 1 year. Of course, it didn't pan out like they wanted.
3 years.
To.
Yeah. 3 years, actually.
3 years, yeah. That was, when you think back on that, they were some games, yeah, weren't they?
And the reason behind it all was, obviously, the first year was 2004, where Armagh and Tyrone had previously played in the All-Ireland Final in 2003. We were kept apart in the draw for the Ulster Championship, so you know, the powers that be, the Ulster Council, probably seen an opportunity for Armagh and Tyrone to play in the Ulster Final. Donegal ended up beating Tyrone. They had already fixed the game for Croke Park, so we went and played Donegal and we beat them convincingly. The following year, 2005, we were kept apart again, so they decided definitely we're not wasting this opportunity. We did meet and we drew in the first game, and then in a game where Tyrone should have beat us, and then the replay we beat them, and then the following year again, you know, we were kept apart again, so why waste the opportunity? Go back to Croke Park again, and once again Donegal were Tyrone's Achilles heel in the Ulster Championship.
Was the public all delighted to go to Croke Park?
Absolutely.
For these games?
You know, we listen, as Conan said, you know, there was three teams in Ireland at that time. It was ourselves, Tyrone and Kerry, who were head and shoulders above the rest. So if there was an opportunity for two of the best teams to go head to head against each other, why not take it to the biggest stadium in the country and you know, give supporters from other counties an opportunity to go and see an Ulster final. From my point of view, it was brilliant, because you know we played three Ulster finals in Croke Park, won all three. You know, I think it was the first time an Ulster final was ever played outside of Clonus or Casement Park or outside of Ulster, and you know, But the everlasting memory for me is actually seeing supporters from other counties going and watching those games because they had an enthralling interest in them games.
Yeah, no, and that's that, like, I think that rivalry just kind of went so kind of, you know, bitter. Well, not so much bitter, but such a heated rivalry that every neutral was interested in that. So selling out Croke Park was a piece of cake, I suppose, for those games.
And the thing about Ulster then was that those two teams, even though they were the best, were getting beaten by teams like Donegal, even Derry. Like, that's where the name Ulster Championship comes from now, and it couldn't be further from that at the minute. Like, when like, I see Armagh have only won the two games in the last 7 years in Ulster.
Yeah, Jesus. And you know, for all of Armagh's dominance in the noughties, and I think it was seven Ulster finals that we got to have and won seven, you know, that our last appearance in an Ulster final was in 2008, and we haven't come anywhere close to getting back to one since then. So, you know, for a team that dominated the province for so long, not to go back to a final in so long, you know, there is a huge dip in momentum, and we should have maybe pushed on from where we were at and continued to strive to get the finals at least.
Yeah, you've definitely slipped out of the conversation. There's no, and it's been a slow slip rather than a huge big jump down. It's just been year on year kind of slipping off the radar of the conversations, which is unfortunate. This week we're hoping that the Ulster Championship kicks into life, lads, because we've down in Armagh, like we said. Armagh are the highest scorers in Division 3. Now, I know they're not a Division 3 team, they're stuck in Division 3, and that's the reality of it, but they're not a Division 3 standard team. Down have survived in Division 2. This is two Division 2 teams playing off against each other, two middle of the table division two teams. Down are 10-11, Armagh are evens. Go out and try and beat each other, lads. Yep. That's the reality of it. Now, you'd expect Down to cover the Armagh full forward line because it's so bloody strong with Clark, Campbell and Murren. You know, they'd be stupid not to put someone back in front of them. But I don't think it's going to serve either team to be going really defensive. It's not in Armagh's game plan this year, Stevie, by all accounts.
No, it's certainly on paper when you look at things, it's an evenly balanced contest. And you would expect, you know, both teams have good qualities in their forward line, so they do. From my own personal opinion, I believe that Armagh just have a wee bit better quality in the forward line. But I do expect that it will be an open game of football. When I say open, you know, I think it would be naive for the Down management and the Armagh management not to play at least one sweeper. You know, so I would expect one sweeper to be playing in both teams, but it'll be a very open game of football. They will go out with an attacking mindset. It generally, that's the way a Down play anyway. This year we've certainly seen a change of mindset within the RMI camp, and they've gone out to beat teams first and foremost, and you know, it's about tweaking things and getting it right at the back as well. And I certainly believe that the Ulster Championship has a real opportunity this weekend to really kick into gear, and the fact that it is a local derby, so much to play for, there has to be a lot of hurt in amongst the Down camp, because Armagh have had the upper hand in recent times. There has to be a lot of hurt in the Armagh camp because they didn't come out of Division 3, and this is a chance to rectify things and turn things around. And you know, both sets of players can take that hurt into a game and give it their all and play it to their maximum, then we'll see a fascinating contest.
Talk to me a bit about these two wing backs. I was looking at the Armagh team that played against Tipperary, and there's a Roland and a McKay, the two wing backs. They're not two names that are springing to my mind straight away.
Roland actually has been, he was in the All-Ireland minor winning team back in 2009, so he was, and he's been a fantastic club player for Colville over the years. He never really got an opportunity in the Armagh setup until the last 2 years, and certainly he's obviously put a lot of hard work and effort in, and Kieran has rewarded him with giving him a starting berth in every single match, I think, throughout the National League at wing half back, and he performed remarkably well. I think actually he scored a few goals and a few points. He is an attacking wing back, and consistently down through the years he has done that for Colville as well. Aaron McKay is a young player. I managed him at under 21 level, a very versatile player. He actually started some games at cornerback for Armagh. He's equally as comfortable out of wing half back. You can actually put him up the wing half forward, and he can play in midfield. So he's a versatile player.
Okay.
This year he won a Sigerson Cup playing full back for St Mary's.
Right.
So that gives you an indication of how versatile this type of player is. He's very athletic. He'll get up and down the pitch. He plays for Drummond Tee, and he's another young player who has grasped his opportunity throughout the course of the league campaign. And you know, it'll be interesting to see how many debutants Kieran Hands to you know, to start against Down this weekend, because there's quite a number. Niall Rowland, Aaron McKay, Stephen Sheridan in the midfield, who has been a fairly you know, he has had a quality league campaign as well from an Armagh point of view, so it'll be interesting to see how many debutants Kieran wants to hand out.
Yeah, and so this was a conscious decision for Geezer to start changing the tactics a little bit this year, because let's be honest, against Cavan last year they were all over the place, you know, they tried this fly goalkeeper and it was way out of left field. Now, I defended it at the time. I think, like, you maybe managers need to think outside the box. I actually would have given that another chance, but it got so much bad press that, you know, and he didn't really have much of a clue how to play in goals. But I would have no problem my goalkeeper taking a 1-2 if you need to break that first line of press just to get out through it.
Gloves at least.
Yeah, he didn't wear gloves. Like, it turned into a bit of a joke, which I obviously wouldn't have been meant as a joke, but it was a bit too drastic, you know, as it turned out.
Well, believe it or not, actually, Kieran, after about the third league game this year, brought in a young fella who called Blaine Hughes in the goals, and he regularly plays wing half forward for his club, Carrick Rubin. So he's a very comfortable player playing outfield as well. And he, you know, what he has provided the Armagh defence and backline with is a coolness under pressure. He's not the biggest of goalkeepers, but he's a quality player under the high ball.
This is Blaine Hughes.
Yeah, he's a quality player under the high ball, and he's got a fantastic kick out. A kick out, you know, just as good as Stephen Cluxton's, and he's sharp on the kickouts as well. So, you know, he can kick it left and right, and you know, I'd be very comfortable with Blaine Hughes in goals, and I would like to see him being handed his debut as well.
So he had no goalkeeping experience before this year.
No, he does play goals for Carrick Rubin, but he also plays some games outfield for them.
Okay,
he was my under 21
goalkeeper.
So he's
the perfect mix,
well,
nearly then.
Yeah, he started for me in goals at under 21 level, so he has experience of goalkeeping as well. And I think he pulled off a save in the Antrim match from a penalty as well, you know, which was very important save at that stage, which took you know, Armagh's chances of promotion into the last game against Tipperary. So Armagh have a lot of positives going for them, there's no doubt. And going back to last year and maybe how negative Armagh were and the turnaround, I believe the turnaround really came from the second half of the second game against Laois, where Armagh were getting annihilated. I think there was maybe 10-11 points in it at half time, and Armagh just came out in the second half, threw caution to the wind, played a brilliant style of attacking football, got themselves back into the game, actually kicked into the lead, but unfortunately weren't able to hold on to it, and ended up Laois beat them. But it probably provided Kieran with an insight into how these young boys can perform when the shackles are off them and they're allowed to perform and play football.
That's a good lesson to learn.
Why did he not see that originally, though? We see all those names in the forward line. Like, why did he not think, let's go attack him with this team?
It's that natural conservative nature. But, like, you look at it as well, if Armagh, this is another thing we have to point out, if Armagh go with this attacking style and Down go, hang on, I know Armagh are going to go to this attacking style, we'll pack the defence and hit them on the break, Armagh could look silly. See, this is the problem. When one team does it, it drags the other team down to their level, and that's like Armagh going really attacking against a defensive team, and they're only setting themselves up for a fall.
Exactly,
that's the unfortunate reality of it.
You can still go with a real attacking game plan, but not commit everyone forward. You know, and it'd be naive for Armagh to do that. You know, and I expect that Kieran McGeaney and his background team will have the homework done, and, you know, will be encouraging their players to push forward at every opportunity, but will also be encouraging, you know, a level of
you know, defense,
personnel to sit back and hold tight, you know, in case there is a break on, because certainly, you know, there's no better team at counteracting and breaking at speed than Down, and if there's any team capable of scoring goals, you know, in Championship football, it's certainly Down.
What's your take on Down now, lads? Because the talk throughout the league was that absolute disarray. They were in an awful state. Then they started getting a few players back, you know, McKiernan and Johnson and these lads came back, and you know, they had some good results. They beat Meath, really, really great result, because Meath had a good league. They beat Derry, and then they drew a Cork to survive in the division. So, like, I mean, where are Down? They've obviously slipped badly as well, you know. Like, my opinion is that Armagh, I would fancy Armagh for this, but, like, you know, what do you think, Stevie? Yeah. You're in the middle of Down there.
I fancy Armagh, but I wouldn't underestimate the threat that Down pose for this weekend. You know, you look at some of their players, they've got experience. They've got Conor McGinn in the forward line, who is a fantastic link player in the half forward line. You've got Aidan Carr, who can play in the half backs or midfield, and he's got plenty of experience as well. Jared McGovern is one of the best full backs in Ulster football at the minute. You know, they've got the Kilcoo contingent of O'Hanlon and the Johnson brothers, Ren and Jerome.
They're back in the mix, yeah.
They're back in the mix, and you'd expect those guys to start. And, you know, having watched Kilcoo down through the years, you know, those guys are quality players and you know, very athletic players that'll get up and down the pitch, but they'll cause headaches for any defender marking them. And if given an opportunity, they're clinical in front of goals as well. You know, also the likes of Kevin McKiernan there, who's another experienced head, you know, represented Ireland, represented Ulster, and certainly will be a driving force in Downs.
Yeah, and he wasn't around for a lot of the league because he was with St Mary's, so that's he only right. came back towards the end, and he gives them an awful spark. Like, I mean, he's a top class player.
He's a great driving player from Downs' point of view. Now, where are Down going to play in this weekend?
Is he playing half forward or is he playing midfield?
See, we're not too sure. Actually, when you look back at the Sigerson Cup for St Mary's, he played a very effective role as a sweeper and breaking out, so he did. But, you know, would Kevin be suited to playing the sweeper role for Down? Possibly would be, but he wouldn't be the type of player from an Armagh point of view that I'd like to see being allowed the freedom of the park to go free, because he can set up attacks and he can you know, follow plays from his blistering pace,
yeah,
as well.
And he come from deep there, and he's very accurate, isn't he?
Exactly. So, you know, I wouldn't be allowing Kevin McKiernan to be the free man, that's for sure. But it'll be interesting to see where Eamon Burns actually decides to play him, because, you know, he's a player that can play in any amount of positions, and, you know, driving forward, you know, he'll be a huge player for them. Other players, the likes of Donal O'Hare, you know, Donal missed the whole league campaign because he had an ankle injury, and he has been back playing club football. He's a player who is pure quality. You know, he's capable of getting four, five, six points a match, and, you know, is he going to get his opportunity this weekend? If I was in the Down camp, I would be throwing him in there, because he's an out-and-out scorer.
Yeah. Yeah, in the full forward line. So, geez, all this talk of the fellas Down have back. Obviously, the talk, they were on a 14-game losing streak, but that's it. They seem to have turned that around. They have their lads back. So, like, it's not as doom and gloom as you would have thought for Down football.
Yeah, they turned it around for 2 weeks, so I think it's a little bit of a red herring them staying up, because they didn't win their last three games, so they're not really. I saw, I think, Ashley McConville saying they're coming in with a bit of momentum, which is probably him being a cute Armagh her, as I would say in Kerry. But, like, you know, they sort of stumbled over the line then. They got a draw against Cork in the last game to sort of make sure of it, but Cork had nothing to play for either. I don't think, like, they only Fermanagh scored less than them in Division 2, so they really, like, they're still sort of on that bad trajectory, I think, and Eamon Burns probably taking a bit of a risk. Maybe they needed it, bringing in a lot of new faces as well and trying out some younger players. But I mean, against good forward lines on Championship Day, against your nearest rivals, you know, I think Armagh will be licking their lips.
And that is where I believe the game can be won and lost, from an Armagh point of view, is if they can restrict Down, which, you know, on recent evidence, you know, the likelihood is that they should be able to restrict Down.
Is the Park Essler thing a thing? What's the records like there? Is that a big advantage for Down?
Absolutely. It is an advantage to Down, because, you know, while we've had the upper hand in Championship games, you know, we've often played Down on Saturday night games in the National League, and they've always had the upper hand on us. They've pipped us by a point or two, particularly in around 2009, 10 and 11, and there was a couple of cracking league games there on a Saturday night. And I actually seen an interview with Aidan Carr just this morning there, and he was saying that the only thing that he's disappointed in is the fact that the game isn't on Saturday night. And he has a fair point, you know, because Down certainly seemed to rise to the challenge of playing on a Saturday night on their lights, and also the fact that, you know, their near neighbours would be coming to town would have added to the atmosphere. But listen, that atmosphere is still going to be created, and it will be there on Sunday as well. But Down in Park Essler, particularly against Armagh, are a formidable team and will certainly put it up to Armagh.
So they never get a home draw either, so they probably are all sort of really up for this. I remember 2013, they got Derry, beat them at Celtic Park, went on, they lost the next round. Derry got through to the next qualifier round, drew Derry again, had to go to Celtic Park within 3 weeks,
yeah,
and then they lost. Like, you know, they always seem very unlucky with the draw.
Yeah, and that's a huge factor in this game in particular, because based on my own experience, we hadn't got a home pitch for a long time, so all of our home games were played in Clonus. And then all of a sudden the Athletic Grounds was developed and we had a home draw against Down in 2011. Now Down got to the All-Ireland final the year before, so they were going into the game as potential favourites. But our appetite for that particular match, given the fact that yes, we were playing against our near neighbours, but the fact that we were opening essentially the new Athletic Grounds was massive from our point of view. So Down now have an opportunity to really go and open Park Esley, even though it's been developed quite a while now, but this is their first home game in quite a while, to go and really open it in the first round of a championship game and express themselves as footballers and show the country that they're capable of footballers.
Yeah, it'll definitely be up for it, there's no doubt about that. Obviously Carlow played Dublin on Saturday night, we'd fancy that to be a pretty one-sided game. The other two games in Leinster look like they're going to be really good games. You've got Loud and Meath in Parnell Park, and we have Laois and Kildare in O'Connor Park, and we're going to have a look ahead to the Laois and Kildare game because Paddy Brophy is on the line now. Paddy, how's it going?
Good, Colin, how are you?
Not too bad. Come here, it's good to be home.
Ah yeah, happy to be home. Been home about just over 3.5 weeks now, so happy to be back with friends and family.
Yeah, and what have you been getting back into football-wise? You were straight back into a league match the week you got back, so there was no rest for you at all.
Yeah, straight back in. It's actually a championship game with Selbridge, with the club, so straight back in starting this Saturday. So I got off the flight on the Friday and straight back in on the Saturday, so just getting back into normality and getting back into a routine.
Right, and what were the skills like?
Pretty average.
Were they?
Just a bit rusty, but yeah, sure. Been waiting the game for nearly 3 years, so just getting the touch back and the skills back.
Right, and would you have kept your eye in at all over there? No,
I would have. Yeah, would have had a kick maybe once a week, but wouldn't have been half as much as I seen before I went. So, and because we're training so much over there, you didn't get much time to have a kick or that.
Yeah, that's true. Come here, talk to us about your decision to leave Australia. When did you come to that decision and why, I suppose?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for a couple of months or so. So it wasn't a rash decision or anything, or a decision I made on the spot. So I had 2.5 years over there and really enjoyed it, and it was a great experience. Just came to a stage where I felt I wasn't going to get the opportunity that I wanted, and you set yourself high expectations, obviously, but sometimes you don't reach them, and sometimes they might be unrealistic or that. But obviously, playing at West Coast, they're a strong side over there. I didn't really see myself getting an opportunity this year. Could have held on for a little while longer, but I was happy to come home and concentrate on football back here.
Right. So you went out and got the trial contract, but then got another contract.
Yeah, so I had an initial 2-year contract and then signed another deal at the end of last year. And I was hesitant in signing that as well. It's just I had a pretty good year last year, so I obviously felt as close to getting a game. So that was one of the reasons why I signed another deal. But
right.
This year I didn't feel like I was making the progress I wanted, so it was time to come on.
Yeah, because that's a strange one, that they would give you the second contract. Usually we see fellas going over there and they last the 2 years, it's not going to be renewed, and they come home. You actually got the next one, which is an important one, but then didn't see your progress kind of improving at all, which is a strange one.
Yeah, I suppose it is, but I had a shoulder operation at the end of last year as well, and maybe that affected it a small bit, but yeah, it was strange enough, but I felt I probably stagnated a bit this year, and obviously I had a reasonable enough year in my second year, and I was playing some decent football as well in this year as well, but I just felt like I wasn't going to get the opportunity, and that's the way it was.
Right. How did you settle in over there?
Settled in really well, yeah. Really good club, really good people as well, and I really enjoyed my time and learnt a huge amount from my time over there as well. Obviously there's times that are hard and you do feel a bit homesick, or you miss football back home and you miss your friends and stuff, but settled in really well and had a great positive time for the 2.5 years I was there.
Yeah, because I talked to John Heslin before, and I talked to Colin Begley, and anyone I talked to that was been in Australia said a homesickness is the most difficult thing. And like I know myself, from when you're playing with Leash and you're not playing well or things aren't going well for you, it can be a kind of like, you know, it's not a great time, but you have friends and you have family around. But when you're over in Australia, so far away from everyone, when things aren't going well, that homesickness is probably heightened.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. When if you're not playing good football, the homesickness is probably the main thing, because you're going across there to play football, obviously, and you don't have your friends or your family that you grew up with, and it's all new to you. It's a new culture, it's a new lifestyle, and it's a new sport as well. So what a lot of times you'll think of is probably football back home or your family or your friends, and you kind of miss those things, and the club will try and help you with that, but it's easier said than done, really.
Yeah, you probably missed a big debate going on here. Oh no, you would have been home with Tomás O'Shea writing a piece in The Independent, and he was criticising Ty Kennelly for recruiting players. I think they're worried down there. They lost O'Connor obviously to Geelong, and there's talk that they're going to lose Clifford, although Ty Kennelly denies that he ever spoke to Clifford. What's your take on you know, the recruitment policy and so many players leaving?
Yeah, my take on it is that it's not Tig that's making the decision, it's the player that's making the decision. So if a club's approaching a player, the player doesn't have to leave, so the player can say yes or no, and ultimately it's up to the player. Tig might have a chat with the player and say that there's a club interested, but he's not the one that's forcing the issue. It's the player's decision in the end, and the people that will help him make the decision are probably the family, and if the player's family are happy with the player to leave, well, good luck to him, because as I said, it's a positive experience, and I would recommend players to go if they got the opportunity. Like I said, it was a wonderful experience, and they'll learn a lot from the time over there.
Yeah, so what's the big things that you would learn from your time over there?
Just in terms of preparation, in terms of like physical preparation and mental preparation, you're a professional athlete 24/7, so you're obviously being educated on certain things, like obviously your mental preparation, your physical preparation, your recovery, your diet, your nutrition, everything. They cover all bases as well, and they also try and help in terms of education. So they really try to cover all bases, and you learn a lot about sport in general, and what makes you a good athlete and a good player, really.
Right, okay, so how far would GAA teams be behind that level, or is it a matter of not having the time that, you know, professional sports people would have?
Yeah, GAA teams aren't far at all, and that far behind. It's just the time, obviously, like being amateur sports people, you're trying to balance work life with sport life, so it's obviously difficult. And while if you're a professional athlete, you can commit your whole life to just being an athlete as well. So that's just the main difference, is the time aspect.
Yeah, really. The time, especially. A lot of people say it's like a recovery. We don't get much time in Gaelic games for recovery, because you obviously have to go to work on Monday. What would your day after a big game consist of over there?
Yeah. So recovery is one of the most important aspects that over in Australia. So if we play on a Saturday, we'd get straight in ice bins after the game, so we'd start sitting there for 10-15 minutes. We'll get into the swimming pool for a little while and then do a bit of stretching afterwards. You'd go home and get your night's sleep, so looking for 9 hours at least, and then the next morning again you're either going to the beach or else you're going into the club and you're doing more recovery, so you're in the ice bins again, or else you're at the beach and in the ocean, you're in there for 10-20 minutes and you're stretching again, and then even the Monday again, you're looking at recovery again, and you don't really get training again probably till the Tuesday, so
right,
you're probably 2.5 days of full recovery before you go again.
Right, okay. And they're obsessed with body fat out there, Colin Begley told me, to the point that he had to drink vodka and still water on a night out so that it wouldn't affect his body fat.
I don't know. Yeah,
is that a West Coast thing as well, the vodka and still water?
Yeah, I don't know about the vodka and still water, but the body fat's pretty is a pretty important issue. Yeah, so you obviously gotta manage what you're eating and your diet and stuff, but it's obviously easier over there because you're training every day and you're burning the calories. So yeah, the body fat is a big issue, but I'm not too sure how the body can still work.
Come here, has the landscape of Gaelic football changed since you've been away?
Yeah, I'm not too sure yet. I've been obviously watching this a bit while I was over there, but I've only been back in the setup now about 2 weeks. So obviously it's getting more and more advanced in terms of technology and professionalism, and then analysis of games and analysis of opposition. So it's obviously everyone's trying to find that them 1%ers to get better and get that edge on the opposition. So it's obviously advancing, but like I said, I've only been back in the setup for a couple of weeks, so I'll know more about that in the coming months.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Dublin are still dominating Leinster anyways. You haven't missed too much there since you've been away.
Obviously they've been the barometer for the last couple of years. They'll be hard bet.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt about that. So when you got the phone call off Keane O'Neill, were you surprised, or were you expecting it so soon?
Listen, Keane gave me plenty of time to readjust and get back. So I've been home probably about a month or 4 weeks now, and he said take as much time off as you need, and he was really good. The whole setup were really good, and I felt 2 weeks was more than enough time for me to take off.
Right.
One of the main reasons why I came home was to play football at Kildare, play football at Selbridge. So I wanted to get back into it as soon as possible, but I just had a bit of stuff to sort out, and then 2 weeks that I had off.
Yeah, and it's great to see you back. Now, Neil Flynn and Ben McCormack are both injured, so, I mean, you know, you could be parachuted into the number 14 jersey before you know it.
I don't know about that. Might be a bit too soon, but yeah, I'm not the one that makes them decisions, so I'll get off the team.
But how long do you think you'll need before you're fully comfortable back with the round ball and, you know, with your skills of the game?
Yeah, I'm improving with every session, so hopefully it won't be too long, but I can't really set an exact time frame on it, so.
Right, okay.
The sooner the better, really.
Yeah, the sooner the better. And Kamir, what are you doing with yourself now that you're home? I mean, I read that you're going to continue your studies, but I presume you'd have to apply in January or February for a college course, or are you in the kind of no man's land?
Well, the college will start again in September, so I'll be applying again now in the next couple of weeks.
Ah, okay.
I had 2 years done in Maynooth, so I can either go back to that or... I haven't really looked too hard yet, so a bit of time to decide.
Right, I suppose that's another thing players need to think about before they go out, is what they're going to do if they don't make it and you land back in Ireland and you're thinking, you know, what am I going to do with my life?
Yeah, definitely. Big thing about it is they try to promote education over there as well, but
right,
it's hard when lads have already started a course and they try and transfer it. There's a bit complications with trying to transfer courses from one country to another, but yeah, it'll work itself out.
Yeah, okay. Listen, it's great to see you back, Paddy, and best of luck for the rest of the championship. I'm sure we'll see you in the, maybe not for the Laois game, I'd be happy enough with, but for a couple after that, after that, maybe in the qualifiers. Thanks, Paddy.
Cheers, Tom. All the best.
Okay, before we get into Twitter questions, lads, I want to quickly get predictions off you. This used to be the last slot, but it's not anymore. So we're going Carlow or Dublin. I think we'll all be agreed on that one.
Yeah, listen, there's no way Carlow are going to come out of this one with a result. Obviously, given the nature of the match, you can expect 14 Carlow players to be almost behind the ball.
Yeah, you wonder, that's the question actually. We might get into that in the Twitter questions. Is do they do that or do they just go out and go for it? Because they're going to lose either way. You know, that kind of way. Maybe they want to be in it at half time. That's the big question they're going to have to ask. But we'll all go for Dublin in that one, right? So we'll go Louth or Meath. That's in Parnell Park. And it's a very close one as well. Like I said, the Leinster Championship, lads, is fantastic competition. You just never know who's going to win in this one. But I'm going to go for Meath in this one. I think they're just that bit better than Louth. Although it is a local derby and anything can happen. This is like the Armagh Down one. It is a very close... there's actually three great local derbies, Down Armagh, Laois Kildare and Louth and Meath, really good ones on the Sunday. I would have argued that Carlow and Dublin shouldn't be on the telly and Laois and Kildare should be on the television, but look, that's just my
You're saying that Louth and Meath will be a close game, and fair enough, you know, Meath are a Division 2 team, Louth have been promoted to Division 2. I actually believe that there's quite a bit between the teams, and Meath are more than there'll be more than value for their win. I think they'll win by at least 5 points at the weekend. I think they're a better quality side than what Louth are at the minute. Louth, you know, while they've had a good league campaign and all, they just aren't up to that level that Meath are at the minute.
Okay, Conan, will you go Meath or Louth?
I'm with Stevie. Meath.
Okay, Leash and Kildare is the only one, because I think we're all going for Armagh, aren't we? We all fancy Armagh.
Yeah, I fancy Armagh, yeah.
Okay, Leash and Kildare. I'm going to, unfortunately, look, do you know what? I'm just going to go for Leash. I think the Leash full forward line can cause an awful lot of damage.
Division 4 Leash.
The day I tip Leash to beat, or Kildare to beat Leash, is the day I'm just going to retire from punditry. I don't mind about my reputation. Kildare are obviously favourites. I'm going to go for Leash in O'Connor Park. Leash have a decent record over there down through the years, and I'll just throw in a shock there. Westmead beat Kildare last year. Nothing really more to add to that. I think Leash have a forward line that can beat teams on their day. They're a solid team, and things have turned around a little bit for Leash, especially that win against Longford. They scored 4-15, so I think Leash can cause a shock.
Yeah, well, I certainly think it'll be one of the closest games of the weekend, and it'll be certainly a lot closer than what the Louth Meath game will be for me personally. Kane O'Neill has his side going in the right manner, you know, right direction, and you know, they are another team coming into this game with huge confidence, having gained promotion to Division 1. For that reason, and that reason alone, I'm going to go for a Kildare win, but only just because I do believe Leash, you know, when you look at their league campaign, they were disappointing, but they were missing a lot of key players as well, and some of those players have returned and are available to play this weekend. So, you know, I have seen Leash quite a bit over the last couple of years because of their matches with Armagh, and you know they can certainly cause problems. I just think Kildare are a better side at the minute, and they will beat them by 1 or 2 points.
Colin, quickly.
Division 1 v 4, I'm going for Kildare.
Right, when you break it down like that, it's just basic logic, right? Okay, we'll come back with some of your Twitter questions. Dear, great to finally get to interview you.
Oh, really, yeah. Why is it great?
Why do you not do many interviews?
I don't know, really. I wasn't being asked to do a whole pile.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Have you ever rang me? I know we spoke about the defensive side of things. If you're coming in and you want to be the Woolly Parkinson and just play for myself, and an inter-county corner forward isn't just hatching inside either. Unfortunately for you, Woolly, it won't last forever. You can ask ex-players that. You can ask you know that yourself, Woolly.
Yeah, mine never started at all.
Yeah, well, that's neither here nor there.
Twitter questions, everybody. We're going to start off with Conor Gleeson, who tweeted in, and he tweeted a link from the NBA website, and he says these are the similarities between US basketball in the 1950s and Gaelic football. And it's very interesting. There's a bit of a match report here, and there's some quotes from a Boston Celtics player. So first, this is just from the report from a game in the 1950s. The game was dull, all too often played at a snail's pace, with one team opening a lead and freezing the ball until time ran out. The only thing the trailing team could do was foul. Thus games became rough, ragged, free throw shooting contests. Right, and then this is from one of the Boston Celtics player, Bob Cousy, I think his name is. Teams literally started sitting on the ball in the third quarter. Coaches are conservative by nature, and it didn't make much sense to play a wide open game. You get a lead, and you'd see a good old number 14 doing his tricks out there. So on November the 22nd, 1950, the Fort Wayne Pistons edged out the Minneapolis Lakers 19-18. Where the games, in total, there was 8 baskets in the game. This is in 1950.
Got the job done.
So I got the job done. Closed the game out. I want no part of that. Right? So what did basketball do? They introduced a shot clock. We all know what a shot clock is. You have to score within a certain time. Now we see basketball points and games
court,
obviously
yeah.
breaking 100 on a lot of occasions. Up and down the court, an exciting game. This is often my point with the GAA. At the moment, we'll see, like, Ulster final last year, very cagey until Tyrone cut loose a bit at the end. It was like 10-11, but we're told we should accept that. And when I suggest with Jarlett Burns a couple of rule changes that might improve the game aesthetically, I'm being hammered about it. What are you talking about? The game's all right, it's evolving. Why can't we be a bit more open-minded about these kind of things?
It's hard to implement change when it comes to coaches having their say on what way they want their teams to play. For me personally, you know, I've spoke to you quite regularly about this. I believe the ratio of training sessions to matches is too extreme at the minute. And what I mean by that is, if there was more games being played, it means that coaches have less time on the training pitch to develop systems and game plans, and therefore I believe that you would see more attacking football. You know, when you look back at the 80s and the 90s, it was man for man, and games were being played that way. You know, there was no such thing as a sweeper, but that's because the inter-county game, they were training on a Tuesday and Thursday and a match on a Sunday. You know, the ratio was 2-1 back then. Now it's almost 6 or 8-1 or even more, you know.
Yeah, a lot of them are gym sessions though, Stevie. They're still like only a limited amount of field.
A lot of them aren't gym sessions. For instance, you know, the team who won the prelim round in Ulster, they have 4 weeks to wait, you know, for their next game. And that means there's at least 8 field training sessions, yeah, you know, plus your gym sessions, plus your team meetings, and also 8 field training sessions to wait for one game. You know, that's allowing coaches and managers to develop defensive strategies and game plans far too much for my leg.
Yeah, but Colin, can they not develop attacking strategies and use that time to do it? Like, I know the Boston Celtics player said their coaches are conservative by nature, and they are. So when people say the Gaelic football is evolving, I don't see it evolving back away from that, because those conservative coaches, Mourinho in soccer, for example, and there's a lot of them, that they'll always be conservative unless they're encouraged not to be conservative. Mm.
But then you always make the point of rugby always like introduces rule changes, but in a way I think that's rugby's biggest weakness, is too many technicalities now, like where you're wondering, like there's a try France scored against Ireland and it was a guy who sort of knocked it from one hand to the other as he tried to pick it up, and I know it's black and white and that's it, but it's like, what is it, like there's no need for that rule. And I think rugby just gets bogged down in these technicalities, and I think the evolution of soccer is better than rugby, you know. So I think if GAA is going to take a leaf out of any book, then I'm glad you're talking about maybe basketball, which is perfectly designed for entertainment. You need a certain amount of seconds to get the ball back and play. Yeah. Something like that would even be good. Like you've 10 seconds to get it back in, or 5, whatever. Once you go over the halfway line, you can't go back. Something like that, but like these positions,
there's
are too many.
There's massive opposition to even suggestion of these things, and that's the problem I have. Like, I mean, there's a clear example from basketball. 1918, yeah, they changed it. It worked. Like, if we change it and it doesn't work, change it back. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Give it a year. But like, there's the opposition to changing it is what I have the problem with.
The mindset of 99% of coaches in Gaelic games is, you know, get the back right first of all. You know, and if they can strengthen, work from the back and try to develop and work their way up. You know, Jimmy McGuinness got it perfectly right in 2012 when he got the defensive structure right in 2011, realised that they're ultra defensive and hadn't got an attacking game plan as such, rectified that throughout the winter, came back and won the All-Ireland Championship because they had serious running potential and running power, but they had also quality players in the inside line as well. You know, so it's about getting the right blend and the right mix, and not too many coaches think the way Jimmy McGuinness thought, you know, as well. And you know, what we have to recognise is that...
Yeah, see, the problem with this, Stevie, is that Jim McGuinness, and he did get it perfect, but every team played into his hands. Yeah. Now no one's playing into these counter-attack teams' yeah. hands. So they're like what, you know, you were telling me earlier, in a league game, if you know the other team is going to do it, you'll do it. So then this is where the problem is. Like, Jim McGuinness' tactics were grand, and a lot of teams' tactics are grand. If the other team plays into your hands, you'll score loads. It's the problem is now, all teams are not being tactically naive, and when the two teams hit each other with the same tactics, that's when you're getting these cagey games. Whereas you'd like to maybe see something to encourage them from not having that fear, oh, they're going to do that, we well, can't, you know, we have to
back. I do think we've seen glimpses of it in the National League final with Kerry being more, you know, forward in their thinking and really going at Dublin as well and pushing a man up on what do you call
Keane O'Sullivan.
Keane O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's ways of doing it, you know, try to push guys high up. I remember a league game that we played against Dromahtee 6 or 7 years ago, and traditionally Dromahtee play sweepers. On this occasion, you know, we didn't allow them to play a sweeper. We pushed our corner back all the way up on them, and we ended up winning the game. And Dromahtee at that stage, from the offset, were looking over to the management team as if to say, what are we going to do here? Because they were allowed to play that sweeper in many of their games. You know, if coaches and managers do take a risk every now and again and push guys high up, like Cross McGlenn do consistently, you know, I don't like harping back to Cross McGlenn all the time, but that's what they do. They push players up all the time, which creates, you know, confusion in their opponents, you know, mindset and how they want to play the game. And if we got more of that there, then maybe we might see more attacking systems and game plans.
Yeah, okay, great stuff. Conor Gleeson, that was the best question we've had yet on the Twitter thing. That's the gold standard of Twitter questions. That's actually a full talking point. You could do a piece on that. You know, that's not the standard I've been used to as of now. Right, next one's from Pat Gallagher. Is it time to do away with the old 1-15 number lineouts, as teams rarely play the team named? just give them squad numbers for the year. You know, squad numbers is one, but also you could also throw into that not only the numbers but the actual 3-3-2-3-3 formations. Are they gone out of fashion or out, you know, out of date as well?
That's so archaic now. Like, you even see it in programs and like newspapers and like websites are still printing them out that way when you know it's not. Like, you know, just put it on that actual formation. It'll be a lot more interesting and see who played where, who was the free man. Tells you a lot more. Like, then, yeah. Why was he so good? Like, you know, you could see it then, like, it was actually lined out properly. They do need to get away with those formations,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'd love to see a change of that as well, because we can get a clearer understanding of exactly who is playing what role and what their job should be for the team. In terms of the squad numbers, I would be a fan of that, because it's something that we've done with the international rules in the past. We've always been given our squad numbers, and once you knew your squad number, I think that's a special thing to have for that particular year and season ahead, and I think it's the way that GAA should go.
Yeah, see, I'm a traditionalist with the squad numbers. Like, the idea to see number 32 playing wing back or something, I just don't like it. Like, in soccer, I'd like to see 1 to 11, number 9 is the centre forward, number 10 plays off him, 11's on the wing.
Yeah,
and
but you're
this
too caught up in the old history of the
yeah,
GAA.
No, I'm a traditionalist. I don't care. That's what I am, and that's it. Right, okay, so that's a very good question as well, Pat. Let me find another one. We have, is Sean Kavanagh finished, as Joe Brawley put it?
What?
He scored 7 points last week.
When did he say that?
Well, I don't know where he said it, but apparently he did. I heard this somewhere else as well.
He said that about 4 years ago when he pulled Conor McManus back. No,
he's not even a man then.
Listen, not even a man, yeah. He scored 7 points last week. You know, he's come out and said that this is his last year in intercounty football, and, you know, for a player that's still able, albeit, you know, the opposition were poor, but he's still scoring 7 points and he's still putting himself out there, and, you know, there's no way Sean Kavanagh still is a huge amount of offer throw.
Yeah, Joe's up to his old tricks there. I'd give this one to you, Conan, to start off with. This is from Niall Kerwin. Is it okay to deliberately get a third black card to serve your one game ban early in the championship? Should Connolly do it on Saturday night?
I think he definitely should, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. Like, he'll miss a...
Imagine the shitstorm will happen if Connolly does this, lads. I don't think he will. I don't think he will. Do. Absolutely won't do it.
I mean, when Dublin get the Leinster final, man, like, all of a sudden then they've got quarters after that and they've got semis. And, like, it's a tightrope the whole way. You don't want them missing any of those games. Get it out of the way. Miss the Leinster semi-final.
Yeah,
but, like, be cynical and be smart about it.
Yeah, but
at the end
know.
Of the day, you know, Jeremy Connolly, he's one of the best players in the country, but he needs to look at his tackling and his reaction to things that take place during the match.
But if you were managing him, though, what would you advise him to do? Listen, look at his tackling.
Well, I know opponents go out to antagonise him consistently, but he has to be able to cope with that there, because, you know, he is probably the best forward and best footballer in the country at the minute, so he has to be able to adapt to those pressurised situations. You know, his tackling, his pulling a man down, his stupidity sometimes on the pitch lets him down, so he needs to, you know, brush up on that there, and I think he can go a whole championship campaign no problem
without the black card. Yeah, black, you'd like card. To think he could. You'd like to think he could. Now, he is a hothead, he could get yellows, but, like, I mean, if he gets his head right, then he won't get one. I don't think he will do it. I don't think Jim Gavin would send him out to black card. I can see the logic of it, Conan, 100%. Jeez, imagine the PR that would... Dublin wouldn't be into that stuff. You know what I mean? You can say what you want about Dublin. They're not that kind of team, I don't believe. Right, two more to go here, lads. This one's from Gavin Quinn, at Gavin Quinn 97. He's just Gav. And the other one's from Declan Cole, but they're both on the same topic. Is there any good Carlo can take from this Saturday? Would it be better off going toe-to-toe with Dubs or try to limit the score? And Declan Cole says, lesser teams playing defensive teams and still getting hammered. Why don't they just go for it? So, you know, they're both on the same line. So Carlo's way of approaching the Dublin game on Saturday night. I know you what you'll say, Conan, before.
The last two questions have made me out to be an asshole now, but I would go defensive because it's their best chance of winning. Like, you know, they're going to get beaten by much more if they go at them.
I know, let's say now they've no chance of winning. Let's call this a spade a spade.
Yeah, they don't, but would it not be, like, for their own preparation for the last 2 weeks, would they not have been better off saying, right, we've got a game plan, like, this could actually work if it comes off, even just if they're kidding themselves? But there's no way they're thinking this boy's going to beat him in a one-on-one and he's going to beat him in a duel. Like, they know themselves they're not going to do it. But if they say, lads, let's get everybody back, let's try and win 9-8, you know, maybe they could just bluff themselves and have a good 2 weeks training.
Yeah, well, it's hard to know. My take on it is Carlo should stay doing the way they're going, and I think that they are playing a sensible game plan. I think that they should go defensive against Dublin. I don't think they should be putting everybody back. I think if they lost by 25 points, it would be an awful setback for the team. If they lose by 10 or 12, they can say we're not that far. You know what I mean? I do think they should go defensive against Dublin.
If you're playing in a certain system, you know, all year round, why would you change it when you're coming up against the best team in the country? You know, and if that system is defensive, which offers them the best opportunity and chance to put it up to Dublin, you know, then my suggestion would be to stick at it.
Yeah, okay, I think we'll agree on that. And in general, with the lesser teams playing better teams, the idea that you would go out and play 15 against 15 against a team that's much better than you is just nonsense. Like, I mean, I don't like ultra defensive tactics, but the idea that you can't play defensively against a team that's better than you and cover your full backline from getting taken to the cleaners, that's just stupid. So there's obviously a balance that you have to get right. I mean, that's what most teams are trying to do and maybe not exactly getting right. Last question is for me. Me alone, actually. Right. So I said I'd answer right. it.
And, so you're not allowed to answer.
Well, you can give
right?
you can give your opinions on it if you want. And this is from Keane Carroll on Twitter, and he asked me, "Who'd win in a fight, you or Paul Kimmage?" So I had a little bit of a think about this, and the tale of the tape says, "I've a huge height advantage, I've a huge reach advantage, I'm younger, I'm fitter." So like it's definitely this, but Kimmage, in fairness, like he's determined, he's dogged, there'd be no quitting him, there'd be no doubt about that.
I'll tell you what, it'd be a brilliant war of words.
You'd have the weight advantage on you as well, like it'd
slightly maybe, I don't know. Yeah, I'm a bit skinny. This would be, I think, a bit like Ali versus Fraser, a kind of a brawler versus a brawler versus
Rumble in the Jungle,
a brawler versus an artist is what it would be. And I think I would go
back artist.
And thinking about, you have to think back as well, I almost beat Kenny Egan in a GA jackass. So like, I mean, this is the level I'm operating on
almost,
inside the ring.
Almost.
That was the most horrifying video I've ever seen.
It's hard to watch. Anyways, listen, we'll leave it for there. We'll be back on Monday with a review show. Good luck.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
The GAA Hour with Colin Parkinson is sponsored by AIB, proudly backing club and county.